Welcome to the Special Court of Review appointed by the Supreme Court. I'd like to make some introductions to begin with, please. To my left is Justa Elsa Alcala from the First Court of Appeals. To my right is Justice Charles Krager from the Ninth Court of Appeals. And I'm Chief Justice Livingston from the Second Court of Appeals. As the parties have agreed, there will be 45 minutes of arguments for each side with a 15-minute rebuttal. We will have a break after the first 45 minutes of argument. I did want to also announce that the proceeding will be recorded with audio recording, and that will be available hopefully sometime tomorrow as soon as the Supreme Court works out those logistics. We have asked that there be no other photographs or other recordings within the courtroom. After we have arguments and rebuttal, we will adjourn court, and then we would like to meet briefly with counsel regarding scheduling issues. All right, if we're ready to proceed, I would like counsel to both sides please announce themselves and who is with them and who they are representing.
Your Honors, my name is Charles Babcock of Jackson Walker. I am representing the Honorable Sharon Keller, presiding judge of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. With me is Kurt Schwartz and Amanda Patrick.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Mike McKetta and my colleague Michelle Altala. We are special counsel to the examiner, Shauna Willing.
Thank you. All right, if we're ready to proceed, Mr. Babcock.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court and counsel and Ms. Willing. The State Commission, we think, in this case, is seeking to expand its already considerable powers over the independence of our elected judges in several ways that I want to address. The first is that the commission in this case has granted itself a new trial, in effect, after it lost the first trial, simply by manipulating its order disposing of the formal proceeding which it itself initiated. And we think that's unprecedented and not permitted by the Constitution. Secondly, it is contending in this proceeding that it can proceed with formal proceedings when it knows that three of its voting and participating members are disqualified under the Constitution, and it contends that this court has no power to do anything about that. Third, it says that it can impose its sanction on Judge Keller with only six votes when the Constitution requires seven. In the initial part of my argument, I want to talk about those three points. And if the court wishes, I have made copies of the slides that I'm going to be using. I've already given a copy to opposing counsel. The examiner knows, we think, just as well as we do, that under our Constitution, that after the commission has instituted formal proceedings, it has only three options open to it. It can dismiss the charges, at any time. It can recommend the removal or retirement of the judge. And if it does that, then we go in a different track where the court appoints seven justices to hear that matter. Or third, it can issue a censure. And the censure can be issued upon a finding of good cause, quote unquote, good cause, on the quote, affirmative vote of at least seven members. That's right in the Constitution. The commission chose none of these options, but instead it issued a public warning, which it now says entitles it to a trial de novo. That's in their papers. We think that the examiner has publicly agreed with us, pursuant to her constitutional authority to speak on this case, And I, of course, refer to the article in the Texas Lawyer, which was based on emails that Ms. Willing, not the best picture of her, I will admit, but where she said that the order that we're talking about is based on a rule, and they're talking about Rule 10M as in mother, that does not comport with the Texas Constitution. She argues the commission should have based its order on the Constitution, which allows the commission only three options after it begins formal proceedings against a judge and after a special master issues a report.
Mr. Babcock, if I might.
Yes.
Is this article before this special court of review?
It is, yes. It's part of the it is part of the appendix that we have attached to our motion. And normally you would think that newspaper articles wouldn't be something that would be properly before the court. But in this instance, there are two reasons why it is. Number one, Ms. Willing has never disavowed these quotes. They are based on an email. It is an admission of a party opponent on a fairly critical point. And secondly, there is a constitutional provision, Article 5, Section 1-A, Parent 10. And that authorizes the examiner to speak publicly about an order of the commission when the, quote, interests of the judge would be served by issuing the statement. And whatever Ms. Willing's motives, we think that she was exactly accurate when she told the Texas Lawyer and the legal community, just as we are telling you, that after formal proceedings, there was only one option open to the commission. There were only three options open to the commission, and they didn't choose any of those three.
In his brief, Mr. Maketa has said that, well, you should just treat this like an investigation because the Constitution says that after such investigation as it deems necessary, the commission may, in its discretion, issue a public warning. What is wrong, in your opinion, with that assessment?
Because they're rewriting the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't say that. The constitutional provision that Mr. Maketa is talking about, we can see the text of it. He is referring to this language at the beginning, after such investigation as it deems necessary. That's the provision that Mr. Maketa is talking about. Then the Constitution goes on to say the commission may, in its discretion, issue a private or public admonition, warning, reprimand, or requirement that the person obtain additional training or education. So that's one path that's open to the commission if after its such investigation as it deems necessary. And if that happens, as it happened to Justice Hecht, the commission issued a public admonition against him for talking about Harriet Meyer's Supreme Court nomination. And so the path that was taken then was for Justice Hecht to ask a panel just like this one to be picked by the Supreme Court, and then we had a trial de novo. And the court issued its ruling after hearing the evidence at a trial. But when the commission thinks that there are more formal, more serious charges, there's a second path that it takes. If you'll say, or, see, we're starting here with the first path, or if the commission determines that the situation merits such actions, it may institute formal proceedings and order a formal hearing to be held before it. And that's what happened here. There's no dispute about that. The commission issued a notice to Judge Keller of formal proceedings and ordered that proceedings be held. Now, the Constitution goes on to say that the trial can either be before the commission or the commission can ask that a special master be appointed. And that's what the commission did here. They asked the Supreme Court to appoint a special master to conduct the trial and take evidence and make a report. And the Supreme Court, of course, granted the request of the commission and appointed Judge David Bershelman, who was at the time and still is a civil district judge in Bexar County, but who was also an accomplished lawyer and formerly himself a member of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And Judge Bershelman held a four-day trial in San Antonio and issued findings which exonerated Judge Keller. He said that she has not violated any written or unwritten rule or law, and that there should be no sanction imposed upon her other than the what he says the public humiliation that has surely been heaped upon her, in his view, unjustly, our view as well, unjustly. This is a long-winded answer to your question, but it goes to the heart of our argument, so I was prepared for it. So the Constitution sets out two tracks. The first one, after it investigates, it can issue a private or public admonition, warning, reprimand, or require the person get training. Or, if the commission determines that the situation merits such actions, it may institute formal proceedings and order a formal hearing to be held concerning the public's censure, removal, or retirement. Or it may, in its discretion, request a special master to hear and take evidence in any such manner. The commission's own flowchart, which it publishes to judges, sets out this two-track system under the Constitution. This looks like the Dallas Cowboys or the Texans have diagrammed a play, but you'll see there are two tracks here. One is there's a public sanction, and then the judge may appeal to the special court of review, and then there's things that can happen. But what they did was over on this track. Tim, can you pull that up for me? Try it again. There we go. And this is the commission's own document on their website that's telling judges, okay, this is what can happen to you if you get on this track. And just as Ms. Willing said in the newspaper, and just as we've said in our papers, once formal charges are filed, there is a fact-finding hearing before the commission or a special master. That happened. And there are two things could happen: a public censure or recommendation of removal or involuntary retirement that goes to a 7-judge tribunal, and the judge can appeal to the Supreme Court of Texas if there's an adverse ruling there, or dismissal. So this is their own flowchart.
Are you aware of any time that the commission has ever issued a sanction in this procedural posture before?
None. I don't believe there has been. I don't believe this has ever happened before, and Ms. Willing is quite right, I think, when she says that this is unconstitutional. She says it based on a rule that provides a larger range of possible sanctions than the Constitution does. And the rule she's talking about is 10M, which they candidly say in their brief is constitutionally out of date. And it certainly is constitutionally out of date, because whereas the Constitution says you have to have 7 votes to censure somebody or to remove them, the rule says 6, where the Constitution now says you have to act by a majority of the commissioners present and participating, in our case 7, since we had 12 commissioners acting. It is surely not in accord with the Constitution, as they admit. According to Ms. Willing's email, Rule 10M is inconsistent with the Texas Constitution, Article 5, Section 1-8, Subparagraph 8. In Willing's view, the Constitution controls, and that's all we're saying to this court, that the Constitution has to control over a rule or procedure that has been promulgated for the court.
There's an old adage that you must be careful what you ask for because you may get it. Is there any other reason other than the constitutional restriction that you have in mind that the commission should not have the lesser sanctions available once formal proceedings are instituted?
Yes, I think that if the commission. And it all goes down to the votes of the commission. If the commission had at that early stage believed and voted that there was that this case was not of sufficient seriousness to institute formal proceedings, they certainly could have taken it down the track of a less expensive proceeding, a less serious proceeding, but the public admonition warning type track. But they chose not to do that. What happened was we had a trial. The trial didn't go the way the commission was expecting. Judge Berkelman made a number of findings that were critical of the commission's case and found that Judge Keller should not be sanctioned. Once we got to the commission, it was clear that there were not seven votes for a censure or for removal. And you remember the Constitution said you had to have at least seven votes. So what apparently there were enough votes for, although we don't know because the commission, despite my request that they tell us whether it was unanimous or whether it was 11 to 1 or 7 to 6 or whatever it may be, 7 to 5, didn't tell us. So we don't know. But it appears that either deliberately or not, they had enough votes to ask for basically a retrial, to get a new trial, a trial de novo, in front of you. Judge Keller had to accept a sanction based on findings that she didn't believe were true and didn't believe that she should be sanctioned. That's the Hobson's choice they put her to, and the Constitution doesn't permit that. It doesn't permit it on its face, and for good reason. The interim effect on judges, you know, having to go through the expense that Judge Keller has had to go through, not merely by one trial, but if the commission can basically grant itself a new trial, now she's going to have to fund the defense of a second trial when the Constitution doesn't call for that. And we know from the Heck case, by personal experience, I might say, that the Texas Ethics Commission takes the position that whereas the commission can hire a fine lawyer like Mr. Maketa for a dollar, that Judge Keller does not have that option. She must pay me my full rate, and I can't discount it in any way. Now, that decision's on appeal by Justice Hecht, but nevertheless, that's the law that she's operating on now. And the Constitution just doesn't allow this. Somebody, one of my colleagues said double jeopardy, but it almost feels like double jeopardy. When you have a trial, you win it, you go through, they don't have seven votes for a good cause for a censure or for removal, and then they just wipe everything out and do it over again. In fact, I know the word is redux, but I thought maybe trial redo is sort of what's happening here. To bring you some background on what's led us to where we are, this almost perfect circle, we started in October when Mr. Maketa and others filed complaints with the Judicial Conduct Commission complaining about Judge Keller's conduct. And I don't mean to suggest that Mr. Maketa was the only one. There were a number of complaints, but they all shared similar characteristics. They all said that the attorneys for this Michael Richard, the condemned man, had requested that the court clerk's office remain open 20 minutes past the 5 p.m. closing time because they had experienced computer failure in the preparation of their pleading. Richard's lawyers had requested the court clerk to stay open for an extra 20 minutes so they could file their petition for stay of execution. They had experienced severe computer problems in preparing the pleading and so informed the clerk. The lawyers needed another 20 minutes. Mr. Maketa pointed out to the commission, quite properly, that his letter concluded by saying, "We ask that the commission determine the underlying facts, and if they are similar to the facts described above and in news accounts, ask that you take appropriate disciplinary action as required by the Constitution." Well, what happened was the head of the Texas Defender Service, which was the defense lawyers for Mr. Richard, had started a publicity campaign to vilify Judge Keller. As Judge Bershelman found, it was all based on a series of lies. But nevertheless, they did it, and they were very successful in convincing people like Mr. Maketa to write letters of complaint saying, if the facts are as Mr. Dow and others say they are, then she should be severely disciplined. And the complaints from Mr. Dow and his colleagues started early, but this is the most complete expression where Mr. Dow tells the Washington Post in an op-ed piece, it's well known that Sharon Keller refused to allow us to file the pleadings at 5:30 when we were finished. A series of computer crashes in our office in Houston delayed our preparation of 10 hard copies of the 100-page petition. Well, there are several problems with this.
It wasn't Mr. Babcock, it seems as though you're heavily going into the merits of whatever the ultimate resolution should be. And at this procedural posture, I think we're concerned about the propriety of the motion to dismiss. And for me, to narrow the question, I'm particularly interested in, let's say you're right, that it couldn't have been a sanction, that at worst, I'm sorry, at the least that they could have given was a dismissal or a censure, and so that you're right about a sanction. So then the question is, okay, well then what? Is it just an error? Or is it void? Is it voidable or what? That's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Sure.
And then the second thing that comes to my mind is, well then, and I think what you're trying to get to is the de novo trial, that it, I think your argument is basically it's not fair to do this de novo. And maybe you're right or maybe you're wrong, but for me, I'm trying to figure out, so if it's not a de novo trial, then what is it? Because when you look at the rules,
right,
and they talk about a review of the record, that applies to a censure,
right,
and this isn't a censure.
Right.
And according to you, it's not a sanction, but then what is it? And so that those are the two things at this procedural posture that for me, I'm struggling with.
Sure. And I think implicit, not implicit, but explicit in your question are some things that I don't think are in dispute. A sanction is not a censure. They don't contest that, so we're with that. The commission did not issue a censure, and it didn't ask for removal. No question about that. That you get a trial de novo from a sanction, but not a censure or a request for removal. The Constitution says that if there is a sanction prior to formal proceedings, then we get a trial de novo in front of your honors. But that didn't happen here. Undisputably didn't happen here. If there is a censure, then we get an appellate type review based on the trial record. Which is only fair because we've had a trial. The judge has, and I was starting to go through, and I didn't mean to belabor the point, but there were a few important findings that this was something that Judge Bershelman found, that this was something TDS manufactured in the media. That all this, and it does relate to what we're talking about here today, because even though this whole thing about they were going to be 20 minutes late, that they had computer problems, that it was a 100-page petition, all those things, totally false. And even though it was in the letters of complaint, even though it was in the original charges, even though it was in the amended charges, it's not currently in the charges. They have abandoned their whole factual predicate for proceeding against Judge Keller, and they can't do that at this late stage after we've gone through a trial. So in answer to your question, I think what we say, Judge, is that you have to dismiss it. You can't have a trial de novo. The Constitution doesn't permit that. We can't have an appellate-type review because there hasn't been a censure. The Constitution doesn't permit that. So you have a third choice, and your only third choice is what we're asking, what our moving our paper is, our motion is, that you should dismiss this and should not force Judge Keller to go through a new trial, wipe out everything that's happened before, and do it de novo, as they say, just like an appeal from JP court to county court.
But why not just treat it as, I know it's not a censure, but from a procedural posture, treat it under the censure rule where we review the record. Why would that be, if that's the best of two options? One option is de novo, which I hear you loud and clear about. Yeah. There was a full-blown hearing. There was evidence in front of a judge. There are findings. So then, if it's not that, then treat it under the procedural posture of a censure. What would be wrong with that?
Well, if the court is into rewriting the Constitution.
Well, obviously we're not, but sometimes there would be
nothing wrong with that.
Well, but sometimes you do have to construe things in order to have a just result. You have to construe something so that you have the right procedural mechanism to deal with something.
And I think it was Holmes that said that, you know, the something to the effect of, you know, people's rights are affected by procedure, and Judge Keller certainly are here. We think you would get the right result if you read the Constitution as it's written, not to use a label, but not be an activist judge and try to get the result you want by reading words into the Constitution that
are not
there.
Well, if we're going to literally just look at the words, well, they called it a sanction, so therefore you get a trial de novo by sanction, end of story. So, I mean, that's the problem when you just look at the label of something, is that then you're not doing the logical analysis that should accompany the decision. So why would it be wrong then to just look at their label if you want us to just stick with the plain words?
Well, you know, Your Honor may have a different reading of this constitutional provision than I do, but it quite clearly says there are two ways to approach it. The first way is the sanction way, or the word or is used, if the commission determines the situation merits such action, then a formal proceeding. So the commission took the or branch in the road, the or fork in the road. The commission should have dismissed the charges. That's the point. The commission didn't have seven votes for a censure. They themselves should have dismissed the charges. We're asking that you do what the commission should have done. When they didn't have seven votes for a sanction, for a censure, they should have dismissed. They shouldn't have taken the other road, which was not open to them, and issue a, you know, frankly, mild, warning, or the mildest form of sanction there is. But that opens up the prospects of either Judge Keller accepting something that she doesn't believe she deserves, or a new trial based on what the commission says.
Doesn't the constitutional provision, though, envision that after there's any type of formal proceeding, that really then the review should be a review tribunal, which is consisted of seven justices?
No. That the seven judges come in when the recommendation is to remove the judge from office.
So really the Constitution didn't itself necessarily contemplate any review of a censure?
Yes. No, it does. It does contemplate a review of a censure, but it's quite clear that it's an appellate-type review. So you three would still be here, assuming you were lucky enough to get drawn out of the hat.
I don't see anywhere in Section 1.6 or 1.8 of Article 5 where it even talks about a special court of review.
Right.
That is just created, that's just a statutory creation, correct, under the government code?
There are two types of appeals, and I've got the exact site that I can get for you in a minute, but there's no question, and I don't think they dispute, that under the government code 33034E1, it's an appellate type review. Same court, your court. It's an appellate type review. Review of the record plus the additional evidence which the court for good cause shown may permit. Or E2, which is a review of a sanction by a trial de novo. And as I said before, I don't think that without rewriting the statute or interpreting it a way that the plain language does not permit, that this court can do anything other than dismiss.
Now, what is the exact difference between a censure and a sanction?
The difference between a censure and a sanction is set out in the statutes, and I will be able to find find it for you in just a second.
Well, part of it was in the E1 and E2 you just referred to out of the government code, but you know, there's a principle that just because you have one method of, I guess, discipline, it doesn't necessarily exclude other lesser methods of discipline. So, and I think that the commission made that argument. But I'm wondering if there's something you see that prohibits that type of reading of the censure set forth in the statute.
Well, the government code in section 330110 says a sanction means an order issued by the commission under the Constitution providing for a private or public admonition, warning, or reprimand, or requiring that a person obtain additional training. And you get a de novo trial from that. Censure means an order of denunciation issued by the commission under the Constitution, order or an order issued by a review tribunal under that. And formal proceedings means the proceedings ordered by the commission concerning the public censure, removal, or retirement of a judge. So those statutes, I think, are fairly clear that the formal proceedings that we had were for censure, not for sanction.
I can read the definitions of censure and sanction. Understanding them is different. but page 19 of the commission's order, wouldn't it be reasonable for us to read in condemnation of the conduct described, does that violate Article 5 of the Texas Constitution and Canon 3B? I mean, doesn't that sound like a denunciation issued by the commission? Could that be interpreted as a censure?
Well, I don't see how you possibly can, Your Honor. They, you know, their order itself says it's a private, it says that it's a warning, and that's what the order says. There is that language, and in fact, if you look at the findings that they made, some of which not only were not part of the evidence before Judge Bershelman, but the most incredible finding they made was that Ed Marty, the general counsel, didn't know about these procedures. And the testimony, uncontradicted from Ed Marty, was that he authored the procedures. So, of course, he knew about them. But those findings that the commission made are, you know, frankly, you read them and you wonder why there was only a warning. But there it was. But I don't think you can stretch the language of the commission when it says it's a warning and some other part into a censure. And there weren't 7 votes for a censure. If there had been, they would have censured Judge Keller. And the Constitution demands that there be at least 7 votes for a censure. And obviously, they weren't able to muster that, so they came up with this. They came up with this approach. I think it bears repeating that. Judge Bershelman said that Judge Keller did not violate any written or unwritten rules or law, and that her conduct does not warrant removal from office or even further reprimand beyond the public humiliation she has already suffered, referring back, of course, to the fact that this was all a media creation based on a series of lies told by these defense lawyers.
Let's assume we granted your motion to dismiss,
yes.
What would our order look like? What would you think would justify that if we were going to say we grant the motion to dismiss because we lack jurisdiction, because they called it a sanction, but it's really not, they didn't have the authority to grant a sanction, or is it that it's void because they were only limited to censure or dismissal or removal? In your mind, what exactly does that order look like?
The order would say this. It would recite the course of the proceedings, and it would say that the commission chose to institute formal charges against Judge Keller. And it went through the process as called for in the Constitution. And at the end of the process, it took the report of Judge Bershelman and heard objections from both sides, and then issued an order that was not permitted by the Constitution and was therefore void. And because the order that is Judge Keller is complaining about is void, it is of no force and effect, and the charges against her are dismissed. That's in essence what your order should look like. Because if the order is unconstitutional, not permitted by our Constitution, it is void.
I'm trying to analogize it maybe to a criminal law that where something just isn't a crime. I'm trying to figure out why it's not just error. Because it's one thing for it to be erroneous, and it's something else altogether for it to be void.
We have cited cases to the court that says when a statute or the Constitution delimits the power, be it a court or an agency in this case, that any time they exceed that power, the decision exceeding the power is void. We cited you cases saying that, and we say it in our brief. If the commission had told Judge Keller that she had to sell her house because she'd been a bad judge, no question that would be a void order. They couldn't do that because the Constitution doesn't give them that authority, and that's what we're talking about here. The Constitution has withdrawn from the commission the authority to do what they are trying to do. Now, the Constitution may be right, it may be wrong, but it's not for this court, it seems to me, to rewrite the Constitution or rewrite the statutes that attempt to enforce the Constitution. And that's exactly what they're asking you to do. They're asking you to rewrite the Constitution. There's another problem that they have, it seems to me, and that is they had three commissioners who were disqualified. As the court knows, or maybe you don't, but the Texas Commission on Judicial Conduct is made up of 13 members, and their qualifications are set out in the Constitution. And they're given class 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Class 1 is a Justice of the Court of Appeals, which is Jan Patterson, right here in Austin. Class 3 was the State Bar members, Mr. Cunningham from Harris County. And Class 7 was Commissioner Fields, who was a judge from Harris County. Commissioner Fields and Mr. Cunningham are both from the same appellate district, but the Constitution says that a commissioner of class 1, 2, 3, 7, or 8 may not reside or hold a judgeship in the same Court of Appeals district as another member of the commission.
But those are different Court of Appeals districts.
I know, but they both live in the same Court of Appeals district.
Well, it's concurrent jurisdiction. You have the
first. It is concurrent jurisdiction. Judge Patterson lives in the third court.
I mean, I don't understand your argument on the other two. If you have two courts of appeals and we have concurrent jurisdiction, what's wrong with that?
I guess, you know, maybe nothing, Your Honor, except that the Constitution says a commissioner may not reside or hold in the same court of appeals district as another member of the commission. They both live in the 1st and the 14th. They both live in that.
Right, but one of them can be assigned to the 1st and one of them can be assigned to the 14th.
That could be. But this, you don't get saved on this one.
I'm not trying to get saved. I just am trying to follow the argument.
Yeah, we're in uncharted territory, Judge. I mean, you know, I wish I could cite your case that says, oh, no, look at Smith versus Jones. But even if that argument holds water, and they make that argument, this one doesn't, because Judge Patterson's in the Third Court of Appeals, and so are Commissioners Mattson and Johnson.
But doesn't that just disqualify one of them, perhaps?
It does, right. Mattson and Johnson are public members, and they're not in the category that the Constitution says are restricted. Says the, that a commissioner of class, and Patterson would be class one, may not reside in the same Court of Appeals district as another member of the commission. Judge Patterson clearly does. There's no question about it. So she is disqualified.
But how does that get you success? I mean, we don't know how these people voted. We don't know if they were part of the six that voted right. for the sanction or not.
It's the same reason that if you have a juror who doesn't who's disqualified for some reason, you don't know how he voted or how she voted. There is a case that was cited by opposing counsel that dealt with a Court of Appeals argument, and it said the judge was disqualified because he'd been at Baker Botts, or Judge Higley. She'd been at Baker Botts.
And then I was on that panel, and the other two of us stayed. And, I guess the court ordered for us to
they reversed the case.
Right.
Yeah. And they said, you know, we don't know. There's all different ways to deal with this, but they said, for sure, if the disqualified person casts the deciding vote, you've got to reverse it. And under that circumstance, since they didn't know the extent of the participation, other than Justice Higley had participated in the proceedings, they said that the matter has to be reversed.
So you want us to remand this back down to the commission?
No.
But the Supreme Court did in that situation.
It
wasn't void is what I'm trying to, I'm being a little flippant, but it was not declared void. It was a reversal, not a rendition.
That is true, except that it would not have been a rendition if it had been a 2-1 vote and that Justice Higley had cast the deciding vote. And we, just like a jury deliberations, we don't know here how people voted. And so we think it's void. And we did cite the Rozelle case that says if a judge is disqualified under the Constitution, which is what we're dealing with here, he is absolutely without jurisdiction and any judgment rendered by him is void, without effect, and subject to collateral attack. And Justice Kilgarlin wrote a law review article about it to the same effect, citing the Frye versus Tucker case. Opposing counsel says that you have no power to deal with this. Even if one or more of the commissioners was disqualified, you don't have any power because it can't be collaterally attacked. It has to be done in a quo warranto proceeding. They do cite a line of cases that stand for that proposition, but the difference is that in those cases, it was a dispute between two private litigants. Here, the state is a party to this case. And we gave notice to the commission, and it's in the record. I wrote a letter raising these points. And under the government code, section 33.0041, it was incumbent upon Ms. Willing to immediately notify the chair and the governor and the Texas Supreme Court and the attorney general. I also notified the attorney general of this matter. So this is a case where the state itself is a party and not in the quo warranto cases where it's just between two private litigants. But if you accept their argument, you could have as many as three disqualified commissioners sitting on this case, and you would have no power to deal with that, and Judge Keller would just have to take her lumps on that. And we don't think that the law contemplates that. And there was another problem with the commissioners, and that was with Commissioner Fields. Even if he wasn't disqualified because he was in the first and the other one was in the 14th, it says the regular term of the office of commissioners shall be 6 years. Commissioners may succeed themselves in office only if having served less than 3 consecutive years. And Judge Fields had been in office over 6 years as of March when he heard this matter, he had been in office more than 6 years. And they excuse that and say that the holdover provision for officers, state officers, permitted him to still be there. But that general proposition, it seems to me, is trumped by this part of the Constitution, which says commissioners may succeed themselves in office only if having served less than 3 consecutive years, and Judge Fields has been on there for more than 3 years. So we thought he was disqualified for that reason as well.
So you're saying there's potentially 4 that are disqualified?
No, just 3.
3, okay, and 12 sat.
12 sat, right.
So that leaves you with 9.
Right.
So why is that not enough?
Well, because we don't know how they voted. We don't know what influence, just like any jury case, we don't know what influence the disqualified commissioners had on the deliberations. And we do know that they didn't have 7 votes for a censure, which goes back to my prior point. And we also know that one of the commissioners who said this at the hearing was unlikely to have voted against Judge Keller because she was quite vociferous. This is a public member, Ms. Mattson, about how we had finally exposed the fact that David Dow was lying about all these things that had made it into the charges, into the complaint letters by Mr. McKetta and others, into the charges, into the amended charges, and the case was tried on these false allegations by TDS and Mr. Dow. So there's another commissioner. We don't know how they voted, but we would strongly suspect that maybe they weren't voting against Judge Keller. I want to, in my 20 seconds remaining, talk about one other thing, and that is the commission has now given up on the fact that this internal operating oral tradition, whatever it was, procedure, was a rule or a law that Judge Keller violated. They now say it was a duty of office, and we think it wasn't as a matter of law. And if it wasn't as a matter of law, then Judge Keller may not be disciplined. And I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. And thank you for your patience. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Babcock. We will now take a 15-minute recess. Well, let's make it 10. And we'll continue with a response at that time.
All rise.